Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this version of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Quick reminder, like us and please rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The more ratings we get on those outlets, not only does it assist us, of course, but it assists everyone that's in the retail podcast segment. And there are a lot of great retail podcasts out there. So let's boost retail as a whole and dole those ratings out. Also coming up on today's show, we'll have two interviews. One, we'll have Charles Jackson of Pricer. They make digital shelf edge labels. He'll talk about how the technology has grown and where the technology is going from here in the U.S. We'll also be joined by the president of PureChem Systems, Jeff Taylor, who will be on to discuss a program his company has to sanitize shopping carts in store. You won't want to miss that. Shopping carts known for being dirty. He'll tell you exactly how dirty and filled with germs later on in this show. But we begin with news. And first, we begin with a company that's not a retail company, but sometimes can serve as a bellwether for those companies in the general merchandise segment. As Procter & Gamble has reported their second quarter earnings as of Tuesday of this week, and the showing down the stock about 3.5% on Tuesday. Now, Procter & Gamble isn't a company we talk about often. Again, they're not a retailer, but they produce and market many of the household brands that general merchandise retailers sell. Bounty, Charmin, Crest, Dawn, Downy, Febreze, Gain, Head & Shoulders, Gillette, all among the brands that Procter & Gamble produces. They made headlines in 2015 when they sold off 43 of their well-known beauty brands for $15 billion. They made it clear the year before that, in 2014, that they were going to be divesting nearly 100 total brands in order to focus on its strengths and cost savings. But this earnings report that we're covering is for the second quarter of fiscal 2018. But when it comes to cost savings, this latest quarter, Leighton, I don't know their margins were where they wanted them to be.
Yeah, we'll talk about margins. And in fact, they ended up going down a little bit. And earnings per share ended up hitting the marks as far as on the non-GAAP basis. But again, we'll get into those details. But Procter & Gamble really is a bellwether, as you had alluded to, Trent, for the retail industry. And it's interesting because this wasn't the best quarter that they've shown here in the recent past. And it's just looking at the stock price over the last couple of years, it's really been up and down because of the divesting. They don't really know what their core competency is. Again, they market and produce a number of well-known brands, but those well-known brands, a lot of them are going by the wayside because of a lot of up-and-coming brands that have been promoting a little bit better on social media and really listening to the customer, exactly what the customer wants on those product labels. For instance, free and clear of any preservatives or dyes, those artificial colors. Those types of things are now found in newer products that are competing directly against those well-known brands that Procter & Gamble has held onto for so long. We see that net sales were up a modest 3% for the second quarter, up to $17.4 billion, a $100 million beat versus Thomson Reuters expectations. However, a lot looked at this like, well, it's just a tiny beat because overall they brought in so much revenue, but you still have to give them props when props are due. This is a 1% positive gain for their currency translation. They do have a lot of sales overseas. And you see that volume and what they call organic sales growth contributed about 2% of the overall increase there. We see, despite decent numbers with what they have remaining in their portfolio as far as brands are concerned, many were telling investors to expect a little bit more of the same in terms of the modest sales growth going forward. We will dig into why that is probably going to be the case, at least in our view, here in a little bit. Trent, again, had talked about gross margin, and it did decrease 60 basis points. And we'll talk about those earnings per share figures in a bit and how they may have been affected by those gross margins. But we see that the company has five main categories that are often talked about here in the industry: beauty, grooming, healthcare, fabric and home care, and baby. And I am trying to minimize those a little bit because they have so many brands, sub-brands underneath those main categories. But we see that all the categories grew in terms of volume except the baby category. However, average price came down in every category except beauty, which was neutral for the quarter in terms of pricing. Beauty sales were the most impressive when looking at all of the categories together, up 9% for the quarter. And this really speaks to how that industry is growing. We talk about Ulta and Sephora, those retailers really having a lot of success. Well, they carry some very strong brands, and Olay was said to be rather strong with product innovation, a lot of new things there. They have some higher priced, higher margin items in there as well. So we speak of innovation. Anytime you come out with a new beauty product, you can really hike up that price, especially if it works and you have the promotion to back it. However, the stagnation in their other products in their portfolio really speaks to our podcast last week when we discussed the continued and somewhat surprising stagnation in a number of markets, including areas like gasoline and other consumer goods that are driven by major market factors. In the Wall Street Journal, CEO Tom Falk talked about Procter & Gamble's price cutting to remain at the top in terms of sales and regain sales as part of the industry's overarching challenge. And this is funny considering the company had just gloated a couple quarters ago about having 28 straight quarters of positive or neutral sales effects from their latest quarters. And I think this is interesting because they can no longer rely on customers to be paying a premium for their brands just because they're well known. We know now that quarters that they had previously were no longer going to hold up going forward in terms of pricing elasticity. And Trent, I know that there are a lot of other groups that are saying that because of these new market entrants, they're really going to be having to focus on the cost-cutting measures in order to boost margins going forward and maintain their competitive posture.
We had one of those new market entrants on the show last week with Tina Sharkey, the CEO of Brandless. And again, it's not necessarily a brandless product, even though the name of the company is Brandless, but it's a direct-to-consumer product, and again, labeling a little bit different, as Leighton was mentioning, than some of these legacy brands. So let's talk about some of these details here in terms of what might be setting Procter & Gamble back. IRI, a Boston-based consulting group, said that larger companies like Procter & Gamble, they're losing market share in the fast-moving consumer goods arena. Think paper towels, napkins, toothpaste, that type of thing, because smaller companies are more differentiated in terms of messaging and understand micro trends when it comes to home care and personal care items. This is what Tina was talking about last week when she mentioned overhauling labeling, making sure that they communicated aspects like gluten-free and all natural to customers, something that the legacy brands have been a little bit late in getting behind. Procter & Gamble's fabric and home care segment did grow in volume by 3%, which the company attributed to more advertising of newer products and better in-store merchandising efforts. Leighton, you and I have both worked in retail, packaging, and design in fast-moving consumer goods, but also this fabric and home care segment is crucial because it never stops changing. Usually it is progressing for the better or wherever design is headed. Logos get cleaned up or updated and they advertise whatever selling points are most popular at a given time. Here they're doing the job well, unlike in some of those fast-moving categories where they are struggling a little bit. Now, the healthcare area for Procter & Gamble did okay, perhaps better than expected, likely due to a number of different illnesses and waves of illnesses throughout the United States. I myself was beset by one just this last week after coming back from the NRF Big Show. Vicks products, for example, sold well. Again, flu epidemic kind of boosting some of those sales. Gillette razors sold well, but at a smaller price point, and that's something that's been in the news recently, in order to compete with upstart subscription-based razor companies and also people acknowledging that razors last longer when you properly dry them. Leighton, I know you've wondered why refills at big box stores are seemingly overpriced. That's something that's in the marketing campaign for a good many of those subscription-based razor companies that you get razors from online. And that's one of the reasons why Gillette has had to cut prices across the board to try and reattract those customers back. However, you look at some of the other issues in this space for a retail store, additional staffing, and also usually having to keep the razors behind lock and key. Those are issues that Gillette is facing as well in comparison to those direct-to-consumer mail order platforms or online ordering platforms. Those are really throwing a wrench in what Procter & Gamble is doing. Baby care has struggled in a number of ways, not because people as a whole are buying fewer products, but again, seeing stiffer competition from new entrants into the area, and that's driving down prices and hurting the newer product sales volume.
Their Love's brand side pricing decrease, which was blamed on Amazon's deeper foray into their private label selection. A lot of analysts said this is directly as a result of that. However, there are other diaper brands out there, a lot of other baby care items to be concerned with in terms of pricing in the brick and mortar setting. This is an interesting category because another consumer-facing company and competitor of Procter & Gamble, Kimberly-Clark, announced on Tuesday that they would be cutting up to 5,000 jobs and close 10 factories. They did have 91 factories worldwide as of last month, did Kimberly-Clark, and will be looking to shed around $2 billion in costs over the next 3 years. And I mention this to say this and that everyone is cutting costs. So you look at their competitors, they're up against them right now, but everyone's looking towards the future, the next 5, 10, 15 years. How will the landscape be? And I think that really speaks to the stagnation or deflation in some of the major market categories that general merchandise retailers cover. They are the producer of Huggies and Cottonelle products as well, are Kimberly-Clark. And you see that when they reported earnings, they were sort of getting positive and negative reviews. Negative because of the PR stance about cutting 5,000 jobs, but positive in that it's going to be good for the end consumer because prices are going to be pushed downward. Diluted net earnings per share, I promised I would talk about this, were 93 cents for Procter & Gamble, a decrease of 68% versus the prior year, due to the gain of beauty brands divestiture and the base period and a current period income tax charge that was a transitional impact from the recently enacted U.S. tax legislation, something that's been in the news a lot. Positive tax benefits, though, however, are going to be grossing $135 million, largely positive for most companies, but some are still having to pay a little bit in terms of personnel that are organizing those very tax returns. After all, they do have to pay their accounting and finance departments. Not really shedding a light on how much more they will have to pay there, but again, tax benefits upwards of $100 million for Procter & Gamble here. We see that non-GAAP earnings per share increased 10% versus the second quarter of last year. So without all of those effects, it's going to be a positive earnings per share beat on the second quarter here, which actually ended up beating estimates by around 5 cents per share. We see that shares, like we said, were off over 3% on Tuesday morning after the release, and they were down for the rest of the day. Procter & Gamble is one of those companies that is more of a consumer bellwether, but that's not really the case as of late. As you can see, the stock has been sort of up and down, but mostly neutral if you look back over the 52-week period. And while many prominent retailers have even been up towards all-time highs, Procter & Gamble has struggled to maintain composure over the last 5 years or so. Shares are now trading around $88 a share after being as high as $94 just in September of last year. Shares are pretty much even, like I said, for the 52-week period, but their chart looks extremely volatile. It's an interesting stock. If you want to get in and get out, you may be able to hedge some swings there, but still, the company has a massive $225 billion market cap. We mentioned their competitor, Kimberly-Clark, as they reported earnings and some bad news for some employees there. Their efforts to cut costs, their stock, meanwhile, is actually up 1% on the restructuring plans on the same day as Procter & Gamble reported. Amazon Go, the cashierless grocery store that is roughly the size of an average convenience store, officially opened to the public on Monday. Many reporters were there from local and national news outlets to report how their experience went and also to interview some passerbys, some of the customers that ventured in and out of the store and experienced the concept for the first time. Lines initially were around the building, which sort of counters the idea that customers will wait less for cashiers. You expect a wait initially to get inside the store. That is sort of counterintuitive to the concept overall. Trent and I probably would have waited a day or two to shop in the less than stellar grocery mix, but we see that the response was largely positive from all parties, including those media members that I talked about, as far as the ease of use in the store. We talked about the Seattle location being open for many months only to Amazon employees and testing out the delivery tracking technology, working out all of the kinks, trying out different methodologies. That location was originally planned to be open to the public earlier in 2017, and they kept having to put it off. We spoke of the many glitches the system seemed to show when customers had too many items, for instance, in their cart, over 30 items, the system would have to shut down. So much of the retail media could actually not access the location and really get the insights into what was going on, what was going wrong. And they were left to speculate about the goings-on inside the Amazon Go location. This go-around, it appears that there were a few glitches, although we still can't know for sure because Amazon really hasn't come out and said anything definitive.
And Amazon is never going to be a company that's going to point out their own glitches in their services. They're going to point out the positives without a lot of the negatives. And that's what you saw about a year and a few months ago when they started pushing out news releases about this Amazon Go location intended for Amazon employees just north of this store in Ballard, Washington. That location was said to be fraught with issues. This store, not so much. How this store works, in order for customers to purchase items there, you have to download the Amazon Go app and then also scan your smartphone's QR code on the way in. Now, you only need the app and a regular Amazon account. You don't need a Prime membership to shop at this particular store. Again, 1,800 square feet, and Layton and I believe the merchandise mix, based on what Amazon has released and based on what media outlets and shoppers there have released, look a lot more like a convenience store than they do a grocery store. I think calling it a grocery store is a little bit overblown given the small square footage and the merchandise mix, where there's a lot of ready-to-eat food there rather than raw food or raw materials to make food with. There are sensors and cameras throughout the 1,800 square feet that track what you pull from the shelf and then track it as you move about the aisles. If you put something back, it'll automatically pull the item from your digital shopping cart. After shopping is complete, you can just exit the store and see that the shopping cart got processed upon vacating the premises. According to some media members, the receipt takes about 15 minutes to process. All in all, that's not bad, provided it works well. And the Seattle Times went out and asked a few customers what they thought of it. One customer appeared to be seasoned, hurriedly got their items and left while saying that this is the way of the future. But one notable glitch came from a CNBC reporter who packed bags full of different items, and Amazon's system failed to acknowledge a yogurt cup. This ended up being a large percentage of their news take on Amazon Go's first public display. CNBC said, and I quote, "We promptly confessed to Amazon, and VP of Amazon Go, Gianna Pierini, told us in return not to worry about it and said that it's a rare error." And Amazon went on to say, "Enjoy the yogurt on us. In fact, it's such a rare error that they don't have a way to fix it." Now, I find this a little bit odd and a little bit intriguing and a little bit interesting, certainly. You wonder how much shrink long-term can be expected from an Amazon Go location. Amazon is not the most transparent of publicly traded companies. You tend to have to be more transparent to your shareholder base when your shares aren't performing well, and Amazon shares have been performing quite well over the last couple of years, particularly with an optimistic price-to-earnings ratio. But, Layton, you still kind of wonder overall if the losses or potential losses from a location like this are worth it, if the technology is worth it, and moreover, if this wasn't near Amazon headquarters, if this is something that can become a repeatable skill for Amazon to put brick-and-mortar locations in many other places. I think we're very far off from the sensors being installed in an entire Whole Foods. That would be much more costly. A lot of news outlets, interestingly enough, are talking about the possible adoption of this technology in Whole Foods. I think they can adopt it to an extent. But again, Whole Foods is approximately 10 times to 15 times more square footage than this store is. That's that much more cost and that much more intricacy. And also items all shaped a little bit differently, and product mix is different at a Whole Foods as well.
You mentioned a great point, and that is that Amazon really is no stranger to losing money on some things. And I think if you look over the past 15, 20 years or so, the existence of Amazon is all about reinvestment and trying different things, whether they win or lose. Jeff Bezos has repeatedly said he's not afraid of failure. And I think that's what's made Amazon such a valuable company and such a great company for the long term. As our friends at The Motley Fool would consider, Jeff Bezos is one of the elite executives for the retail industry. And I think Jeff Bezos has even reportedly shopped at this store multiple times, and he, quote, loves the concept. So we'll be watching this closely to see if they adopt any of the technology, like you've said, into the Whole Foods location, or whether or not they're going to sort of wait and see, take that approach of letting this Amazon Go location head out for another 2-3 years, work out additional kinks to make it maybe a little less costly if you were to implement it in those larger Whole Foods locations. After all, they do have over 470 locations as of December of last year, so that's a lot of locations to roll this out, and again, a very expensive program if you were to do that. So I think they will take the wait and see approach. Again, Jeff Bezos not afraid of failure here. I think he already looks at this like a success, if not only for the positive PR this has gained. And speaking of Bezos, he is Amazon's largest shareholder. After the largely positive news on this Amazon Go location, Amazon shares were up around $35, or that's representative of 2.6%, with the share price approaching close to $1,400 a share. With over $650 billion market cap, Bezos now boasts a net worth of $113 billion, according to Forbes' calculations at least. This makes him the world's richest person, but he may be the world's smartest and most innovative person at least if this concept works out. I would be, in fact, for the record, happy with just 0.1% of his net worth. I know you would be too, Trent.
So those are our top two news stories we're following at the Retail Focus podcast. Coming up after this, we jump back to NRF 2018 and back to the podcast booth at NRF 2018, where we're joined by Charles Jackson. He is the president of Pricer Group. Again, we're going to be talking digital shelf edge labels and advancements in shelf edge label technology through North America, but also in Europe. Before we jump out to one conference, I want to talk about another. That's the Internet Retailer Conference and Exhibition. IRCE is your one-stop shop for all of your e-retail needs. This conference and trade show offers you everything your business needs to stay ahead of your competition in one simple location. Spend some time to learn, discover, and network. IRCE 2018 will take place in the world-class city of Chicago, June 5th through the 8th at McCormick Place West.
It's going to be a massive conference as IRCE is going to offer two full conference days with various tracks, with pre- and post-conference workshops discussing all the new industry trends. Their exhibit hall at IRCE features over 600 top solution and technology vendors that are ready to help your business succeed in every facet. The hall covers over 250,000 square feet, making it the largest e-commerce trade show in the industry, ensuring you'll find the solutions you need.
250,000 square feet of space, about the equivalent of 10 Whole Foods, give or take. Let's talk about some of those main stage speakers. They've got Dave Gilboa, the co-founder and co-CEO of Warby Parker, will be there, as will Mariah Chase, the CEO of Eloquy. The numbers, 10,000 attendees, 600 plus solution providers, and over 130 conference sessions with over 200 speakers. Go to IRCE.com and click Register to Attend under the Attendees tab and enter promo code RETAIL18 for 10% off conference passes. Again, that's promo code RETAIL18 for 10% off conference passes at IRCE.com. And our next interview in our NRF 2018 interview series is Charles Jackson. He's the president of Pricer. And one of the reasons we've brought him on the show is because oftentimes I know it can be overlooked by retail customers, certainly, but sometimes retailers don't really think about advancements in technology at the shelf edge. But the shelf edge is so important. It gives a lot of information to the consumer, and there's a lot of innovation in shelf edge technology. And we wanted to reach out to someone from Pricer, who is a shelf edge technology firm, to discuss it a little bit. Who better than the president? Charles, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
All right, so let's step back and take a look at the world of shelf tags. Over the last decade, 2 decades, 3 decades, where have we been and where are we going in terms of the shelf edge?
Well, in your question, you can hear how long the story's been. I'm a bit of the yardstick here. Based in Paris during the uptake there since 1999, we saw France go from a few pilots to total adoption, really starting with food and then leading to DIY and pharmacy. And then finally, in the last 3 years, electronics. That has bled into Italy, Spain, Portugal, Belgium, the rest of the markets around. And Europe today has many markets that are 100% adopted. The fact that I'm talking to you from here now is because I moved to Atlanta very recently because this story is now going to continue from the North American side. But North America and England have been two markets that have avoided electronic shelf labels for so many reasons, including amount of data at the shelf edge, technology gambles, the urgency, the technological ability to support price changing. All these stars had aligned in Europe, and they haven't quite been there in the U.S. Although, on the other side of the border, you take Mexico, we have most retailers have adopted or are in the midst of adopting electronic shelf labeling.
So we talk about some of the hurdles, or some of the barriers to entry for some businesses. What are some reasons why businesses should or would adopt electronic shelf labeling?
Again, in your question before, you hit on it. The urgency hasn't been there. At the same time, the technologies just weren't right for the type of theatrics that American retailers need. I'm more specifically talking about food, of course. BOGOs, the data, the information for the shopper is much more elaborate than it is in continental Europe or Mexico. And that data just hasn't been able to be squeezed on the little piece of real estate. Now, there are new technologies out there, and E-Ink, an American startup some years ago, has created, well, it's used by Kindle, and that graphic display is able to imitate paper, and that's changed the game. And now they're coming out with colors. All the electronic shelf label companies have adopted this new display. The price is still more significant than the segment, but this means that now we can imitate paper at the shelf edge. But again, you need the urgency. The investment's high, and retailers have many priorities. These priorities are now aligning with us. Online synchronization of the price, competitive situation. All this means that retailers are going to have to step up their game, like you said, and adopt ESL. And what we probably will see is not big rollouts like the European style, but we're going to see more department type rollouts. If you're a Kroger's, maybe you just do your fruit and vegetable, and that's where you attack. You attack shrinkage, price competitiveness right away. Your fresh area is your biggest play now. Maybe you just hit your dairy departments, your bakery, et cetera, and then you slowly bleed into the lower margin products, the center aisle. We might see that. On the other hand, as I say that, we just announced yesterday that we've rolled out the first 60 stores, full stores with Best Buy. So, of course, I'm contradicting myself. But I think we're going to see a lot of department adoptions in this market.
So a slower rollout rather than full store rollout.
Yeah, and using larger signage. Signage that can, the real estate on the larger signage can hold all that data, the data the Americans want. This same situation happens in England. England is the only market in Europe that has not adopted electronic shelf label because of the same theatrics that goes on in the stores. The shopper expects to have a lot of information about the product and a lot of comparison shopping going on at the shelf edge. Vitamins, or at least data about the product itself, ingredients, gluten, et cetera, et cetera. The American shopper is very demanding, and ESL isn't quite able to follow completely.
So that's something I want to go a little bit beyond kind of our pre-conversation and ask you a follow-up to that, because I think it's interesting from a cultural perspective, certainly. What are some of the different things that you're finding that American consumers or English consumers demand that maybe weren't demanded in other markets? You mentioned gluten-free being one example.
Well, that's a good question. Right now, product searching for product is becoming a big requirement in Europe. And we're still not seeing that. Food in the U.S. has not been hit by online yet. The fear is there. The Amazon story is there. But food still has the reliable shopper going to the store, discovering new products that he can blend into new ingredients, new recipes. And the American shopper, he has an advantage by the incredible assortment that the American retailer. You must have 40 different ketchups, 50 different mustards. You just don't have that in Europe. And that is going to be a hard habit to kick for online, because the shopper wants to look at the product, wants to read the package. The experience in the store is very high level in the U.S., and it's a bit more commodity in Europe.
I probably have 50 mustards in my fridge at home. I'm not going to lie. I love mustard. One of the benefits, though, of electronic shelf labels is dynamic pricing. And I think you're going to see more retailers eventually begin to adopt this type of model. Why, from a retailer's perspective, is dynamic pricing important?
Well, first of all, as a shopper, we're expecting our retailers to be more nimble, faster. There's a great statistic that we love to recall, Capgemini, I think, on 65-70% of shoppers think they know more than the retailer. And that is because they slowly are using online more and more in all their purchases. And they're getting used to that airline-type discounting, surge pricing, and they accept it. And that kind of acceptance is leading retailers to test dynamic pricing in the stores. At the same time, commodity prices are fluctuating like crazy, and retailers must take advantage of it, and they are. Believe it or not, the Walmarts of this world are doing dynamic pricing, and that's just bleeding into everything else they do. The other thing is that the back office systems can support it now. This is something that most consumers would probably not understand very well, but it is a huge legacy issue for retailers to step up to bat and do dynamic pricing. Only the biggest and best are doing it today, and they can support it. We could have given a free electronic shelf label system to a major 300 store retailer 20 years ago, 10 years ago. They wouldn't have known what to do with it anyway. But today they can, and now they can, and the algorithms are there. So dynamic pricing is possible, it's accepted by the customer, and it is brings competitiveness and online synchronization.
You mentioned Walmart and their dynamic pricing practices. I know the produce section is probably the most touched section by dynamic pricing, that and dairy. In terms of that, though, if you look at a Walmart, they're having employees go through morning by morning and change every single price there. So that's another aspect of this dynamic pricing model is switching over. You got to account for labor, and the electronic shelf labels tend to take that away.
Exactly. And the retailers face, unfortunately for them, but reasonably, they face the pressures of their city, the community, the charities, the retailers do face many more pressures than most. And reducing shrinkage isn't only an economic issue, it's a brand issue. And Walmart needs, all retailers, whether in Europe, they need to address shrinkage. You can't have all the cabbages thrown out the back door anymore. It's just not acceptable from a brand point of view, a community point of view. So lowering those prices during the day, doing it so that the shrinkage is reduced at its best, even maybe losing a bit of money, but getting those cabbages out is becoming a brand challenge for the retailers.
Well, again, Charles Jackson, our guest, he's the president of Pricer, and we're talking about shelf edge technology. And we've mentioned where adoption might take place in the U.S., but there are several firms that have already adopted shelf tags that are electronic in the United States. And I mentioned to you before the interview, it seemed like liquor stores, just in terms of anecdotal evidence, seem to use it more than other firms. Are there some types of retailers in the U.S. that are ahead of the game over others?
Yeah, and it's also easy. Liquor firms, their issue is not restocking a shelf. They don't have people that can't keep up with the milk demand. So reducing the labor effort in the store counts. They can get that staff to concentrate on the customer, and anything that supports that and controls the pricing and the dynamic pricing again is a win. It's a quick win. The grocer, he's got his staff on the floor. They're running around trying to keep the Nestle's Quick up on the shelf. And so the retailer is still depending on him to change that price at the same time. What we do know is that luxury is quick dissipating. He's got to move his staff from those back office tasks to front office tasks, helping the customer. And he's got less people to deal with. And of course, the employment market is fantastic now in the U.S., so that challenge is there. All these things mean, and the regulatory pressures, so all these things that liquor stores have the true quick benefit, but the grocers and the electronics and so on are having to go there anyway.
Another reason why some retailers are hesitant to adopt shelf edge technology, and I don't want to use the term necessarily oversaturation, but going through the conference here, there's a lot of different people with shelf edge technology. Some of it looks like it's on the precipice of being rolled out and it's not ready yet. Some of it is really expensive.
It's an incredibly attractive industry. It's an industry worth billions and billions of dollars because it's counted in the number of shelf labels there are out there. You don't have to be some MIT or Stanford business school graduate to understand that this is a huge market. We have seen over 50 credible competitors come in and leave. And I'm including people like Kodak, Xerox, Seiko, Sharp. It's been a constant battle with new entrants. And they usually pick technologies, radio usually, that they believe are able to scale in a retail environment. And of course, and everybody who's worked in retail knows that the retail store is an odd affair. You've got metal everywhere, humidity everywhere, dog food, people. All this means that technologies have a hard time to scale in that environment. Every retailer has lived the nightmare of Wi-Fi deployment. And
yes.
So you can imagine with those heavy protocols and the investments made so far and the difficulties it's had, imagine now talking to 30, 40,000 small modules on the shelf edge. So the technology challenge is there. And you're right to bring this up. This is a bit of a technology war.
So one of the benefits with Pricer is that obviously you guys are very well-trained in the shelf edge space. You guys have been at it for quite some time. But how do you as a company manage the scalability? Because you're not only talking about all the shelf labels in one store, but you're talking about rolling them out over entire chains of stores too.
We had to make a decision a long time ago when we faced the largest deployment at the time in Europe. We had two technologies. We had radio and infrared. And it was clear from the start that the demands of that particular tier one were never going to be satisfied by radio. So we had to take a gamble, and that's what's been our blessing. We gambled on infrared, and infrared has no scale issues, no interference issues, no speed issues, and no battery issues. And that decision has been the foundation of our company. And it's why the industry is in this technology battle, because we've created a standard, and the radio companies that launched, the Xeroxes and the Seikos, have tried to imitate our battery life, our speed, and they simply can't do it.
So I want to wrap this up by looking ahead. We've got already leaps and bounds here in the last 10 to 20 years in the United States. There's still a lot of stores with paper printed label, shelf edge labels. But I want to look ahead at the future. Where is the industry going in terms of shelf edge labels? What are kind of the next big things, without giving away company secrets or anything like that?
No, you're absolutely right to ask, because first of all, the retailers are asking, and we're all, the industry is going to have to deliver. And what it is the electronic shelf label in its purity now is actually a clone or a digital representation of the product. So that means that since it's digital, you have to know where it is. You have to make it do something, give you information, and get that engagement going. So what does that mean? There are all sorts of technologies, whether it's positioning the product, putting NFC in the product so that you just tap it with your phone and you get redirected to a website or a video. You tap it, it's included in your basket. You tap it, you find out what the newest product in that range is. There are all sorts of things that retailers are asking us now to help them engage the customer. And by the way, retailers are, they're very specific in their pain points. They're really addressing point solutions now to step forward gradually, bridging the online. They're not expecting their store to become some sort of Star Trek tomorrow. What they do expect is them to make a step-by-step approach where the customer naturally feels that the experience in the store and the online experience are really one and the same.
And without disrupting the experience of those who maybe aren't used to the online experience
exactly.
As well. All right. Charles Jackson, president of Pricer. This conversation's been phenomenal. I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much for joining us here on the Retail Focus podcast.
Great questions. Thanks a lot.
We thank Charles for joining us, and what's more, I want to thank Laura with Pricer for setting that interview up. It was a fantastic interview, learned a lot from him, and it was a lot of fun talking to him and the entire Pricer crew at the conference. Now, we turn our attention to two more news stories before we hop into another interview later on in the show with PureChem Systems. We're going to talk a little bit about Toys R Us. There were strong indications that the company was looking to close up to 100 locations in order to maintain liquidity before Christmas hit. But now we have a solid number coming out of the embattled toy retailer as January nears its end. As we've noted in the past, the retailer initially hinted after they filed for a Chapter 11 bankruptcy that they may not have to close any locations, but pretty quickly, right before the new year, this number went from zero to around 100. Now, as of late Tuesday afternoon of this week, that number exploded upwards to 182 stores.
The company said in documents that some of these closings could be avoided if they were able to renegotiate lease terms. However, they're not really saying exactly how many stores could be renegotiated. So a lot of stores, a lot of employees are going to be left in limbo, at least for the short term. Most likely, they're trying to get lease rate reductions or at least a little bit better terms in terms of locking in lease rates. A lot of commercial leases, as a lot of our listeners know, are a little bit more lengthy in terms of the overall timetable. But some commercial landlords may view Toys R Us as a valuable tenant in shopping centers as an anchor and be willing to come down on rents in more mature areas that have already seen declining traffic levels. It is not clear if it has already been happening, but we would have actually liked to see this renegotiation happen either before or around the bankruptcy notice. I think this dialogue would have been helpful for the building owners. And if it's just now starting, that's a bad sign. That's mismanagement by those Toys R Us executives, which, by the way, just got a hefty Christmas bonus. Most of the affected locations will begin liquidations in February and close permanently sometime in April. Again, no exact timeline. The company is still not sure what locations are going to be closed, so we don't have a full definitive list, except to say that some regional news outlets are reporting that their stores are closing. One in New Jersey, in fact, said that 12 of their stores there are going to be closing for good. And we think this would be unlikely to see newer, smaller footprint stores that we've talked about in the past. We applauded their decision on opening in outlet locations, a little bit less of a lease and a little bit less in terms of the overarching overhead that's going to be tied to the operating those stores. But you see that in all, the reduction will produce a 20% less store footprint in the United States and will cut a whopping 6.9 million square feet of selling space. Again, we have to say all of these numbers with the caveat that they don't know every single store that's going to be closing, because last minute they could renegotiate a lease and then therefore actually have less stores closing by the end of things. But you see that a statement by their CEO, Dave Brandon, in a letter on Tuesday said that the reinvention of their brands requires them to make tough decisions about their priorities and their focus. They planned on driving through previously stated initiatives like providing better supply chain, being a little bit more streamlined, and being more digitally integrated. He said before, Dave Brandon has, that they need to get with the times in terms of being fully omnichannel. They also want to combine both concepts, which is actually the first time we heard about this, Trent, in the recent past. The Babies R Us and the Toys R Us banners in areas that haven't really combined already. And I said haven't combined already because, as many of our listeners may be aware, they've actually done this over the years before Dave Brandon actually was at the helm. They've already had a significant amount of coming together with these two banners, although some locations, I should say, actually switched from being a Toys R Us to a full-scale Babies R Us, making us wonder why they would have been able to use such a larger footprint and combine the two instead of just having one come into the other and not splitting it 50-50 like some locations around the United States. The retailer has until mid-July to get everything done, which includes lease renegotiations as well as financial engineering with current creditors, something that has popped up repeatedly in the news as Sears' battle with vendors in terms of credit terms for inventory because suppliers outright know their financial constraints. We see that Sears is losing hundreds of millions of dollars. Why would you want to give them better terms than your other retailers? So we'd be curious to see if they're going to be doing the same thing with Toys R Us in the next few months. After all, they've already filed for bankruptcy, but now they're outright closing locations. So I don't think either Trent or I would be surprised to see this happening with their suppliers in the coming months.
Vendor relations, an absolute key for Toys R Us if they're to stay open. Remember, back in 1991, it was vendor relations that beset Child World and Children's Palace right before the holiday season and pretty much crushed them financially, ensuring their not only their bankruptcy, but their permanent closure. Well, we move into the C-store industry now. As we mentioned, Amazon Go's size relative to convenience stores. So it's only right that our final story on the Retail Focus podcast today is about a massive convenience store merger that was just announced as potentially being finalized and greenlit by the FTC. Convenience stores of recent vintage have done quite well. They're trying to get people in to buy ready-to-eat meals a little bit more than in the past, but loyalty programs that we've discussed in previous episodes of the Retail Focus podcast have been major drivers of bringing in some of this in-store traffic. In-store traffic means higher margins because those convenience stores earn more money on sales inside the store itself than the sales out at the gas pumps. That means a lot of the larger players in the convenience store segment in the U.S. have looked at their competition as more of an opportunity to grow through acquisition rather than a long-term adversary, and we see that being the case here. Via Maria Halkias, the ever-excellent business writer at the Dallas Morning News, who is on top of a lot of Dallas-area retail news, but also pretty much anything that comes out of companies based in Dallas, reports that 7-Eleven has now finalized a deal worth about $3.3 billion for parts of rival Sunoco. Both businesses are based out of the greater Dallas-Fort Worth area, with 7-Eleven based, at least on the U.S. front, out of Irving, Texas, and Sunoco based out of Dallas. The deal will include about 1,030 stores in all with multiple banners. The banners include Stripes, Sunoco, and Laredo Taco Company. And what's more is they are buying the brands Stripes and Laredo Taco Company. Because of that, it remains to be seen whether they will rebrand Stripes to 7-Eleven in the future or keep the Stripes branding in place. Sunoco, though, retains the rights to their own brand. Laredo Taco Company, by the way, in case you're wondering what that is, that's not a freestanding convenience store, but that's a restaurant in C-store concept that has a presence in C-stores in Texas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico. But this deal, which we've talked about in passing before on the podcast, was proposed originally in April. It was a larger variation of this deal that was proposed in April, but it was finally closed after 7-Eleven agreed last week to settle FTC allegations that a potential acquisition from Sunoco would violate some antitrust laws. Specifically, the Federal Trade Commission findings concluded that there would be 76 specific areas in 20 larger cities in Florida and Texas where they felt like customers would have fewer gasoline options as a result of the merger as originally proposed, and therefore could potentially pay higher prices at the pump going forward. Now, this level of insight into what they deemed unacceptable was almost refreshing in that the FTC said that they were looking at only locations on the same block or just a couple of blocks away. With gas stations, just as with grocery stores, you have to worry certainly about fuel center deserts. And because of that, the FTC taking a microscope to this transaction, a little bit better, we feel like, at least on the surface, above the due diligence that was done in the Walgreens Rite Aid deal, which was looking at the overall large number of stores that were going to change hands rather than looking at things on a neighborhood by neighborhood basis. This would have taken a massive amount of resources by the FTC in the discovery phase, and you have to applaud their efforts to some degree, with or without the belief that the FTC is trying to protect the best interests of the consumer, as it seems like they did some very deep due diligence on this particular deal. In any case, as a result of this FTC ruling, 7-Eleven will sell 26 of their existing stores back to Sunoco. So these are existing stores that Sunoco didn't originally own. And then Sunoco removed 33 stores out of the sale, which leaves Sunoco with 59 stores out of this deal. Meanwhile, again, over 1,000 going back the other way. Some of these stores involved in this 59 that Sunoco will retain are in Virginia, but most are in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas, also Corpus Christi and the Laredo metro areas. One would assume Sunoco might look for a different buyer for these 59 total locations they've retained because, Layton, they want to try and get out of the C-store industry and just become a fuel supplier.
Yeah, you really have to question Sunoco's motivation here to sell off all of these locations because, as we've been saying on this podcast, on this very story, is convenience stores have been doing quite well in terms of margins, in terms of traffic. However, Sunoco has said that motivations lie mostly in streamlining their own operations with the fuel side of things and focusing on being just a gasoline supplier in the future. For 7-Eleven, reasons for the deal are fairly clear. We've talked about Texas being a growing retail market to begin with, and the same is true for the C-store industry. Gradually, convenience stores in Texas are expanding square footage, upwards of 2,000 square feet, to incorporate more fresh food options. Additionally, convenience store giant Quick Trip is expanding their reach in Texas, which has planned locations in Austin and San Antonio. All this means that it will be important for 7-Eleven to continue growth plans to keep up because, again, scale is it with convenience stores. The more items you can buy at bulk, the cheaper you can price them, the more competitive you'll be. And for 7-Eleven, this represents their first entry into Houston and boosts their total number of locations to 9,700 in the United States and Canada if you combine these two countries. And as always, the kicker, the deal includes a 15-year fuel supply agreement between 7-Eleven and Sunoco, which also carries a commitment to grow demand by 500 million gallons in the future. So this is going to be a long-term setup that's going to provide a revenue source for Sunoco. Sunoco was not likely to agree to the deal without this specific provision. This allows Sunoco the security of continuing to supply fuel to the locations they are selling off, meaning that they will still be involved in the chain and taking a piece of the pie, just not the in-store pie. And you can actually look at the number of locations that Sunoco is actually keeping and actually selling off more as a franchise operation on DallasNews.com. They have a nice list of all the locations, including the ones that were actually transferred over from the current 7-Eleven portfolio. A very good, insightful piece if you live in the area to kind of see what's been going on with convenience stores, which ones are going to be rebranding going forward. And I think this is really telling of an industry that has grown by leaps and bounds over the last few years in terms of acquisitions, in terms of divesting parts of the business to be able to be more streamlined going forward. A very interesting story and one that's been in the works for quite some time.
Well, after we come back following the music, we'll continue our Deconstructing Retail interview series by looking at the shopping cart. We're not looking at the design of the shopping cart, but rather the germs on the shopping cart. We're joined by the president of PureChem, Jeff Taylor, right after this. Well, in this week's podcast, we helped to kick off a month-long segment of interviews we call Deconstructing Retail, where we're looking at different aspects of retail that might be overlooked, certainly by the consumer, but also by the retailer themselves. And joining us here today to talk about the shopping cart, but not the design of the shopping cart, is Jeff Taylor. He's the president of PureChem Systems, and they make a series of products designed to clean and sanitize surfaces. Most notably, they have the PureCart system, which helps to sanitize shopping carts in a store environment. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us today on the Retail Focus podcast.
Thanks, Trent. Thanks for the opportunity.
So first of all, I think to establish this, just how dirty in terms of germs is the average shopping cart? What are a lot of consumers overlooking here in terms of what might be on that average grocery store shopping cart?
Yeah, it's a great question. Actually, there's been several studies done. There was one by the University of Arizona. Shopping carts are actually considered one of the dirtiest or germiest public sectors that you can think of. There's actually more germs or more germ content per square inch on a shopping cart than typically in a public restroom. And I know that sounds kind of odd, but one of the reasons for that is restrooms are cleaned and sanitized on a regular basis. Shopping carts are not. Usually it's just an afterthought. What happens is, you know, they get left out in the rain, and a lot of people go, oh, well, you know, there's not a giant sticky mess on it. It must be clean. But the reality is you don't know who used it 2 seconds before you or 2 days before you. It could be somebody that has the flu, has a cold. Could have been a kid sitting in there with a dirty diaper. Could have been the busy shopper right before you that happened to put some raw chicken or something in the same area that you just put your kid in.
And I think you bring up a great point here, because I think a lot of people look at the shopping cart and they say, well, that handle that we grab, you know, obviously there are ways to sanitize that in the front of the store. And a shopping chain might say, well, we give sanitizing wipes, but it goes above and beyond that, it seems like.
Yeah. So as far as we know, this is the only system that's designed to purify the entire shopping cart as well as other areas of a retail environment. So you're right. There are wipes. There are other things that are out there. There's little strap-on baskets that you can bring with you and put in there. And those really kind of address the handle or the basket area. But there's a lot of different areas of the cart that you're coming in contact with, or that your kids are coming in contact with, or your food is coming in contact with. So indirectly, you're still contacting it.
One of the interesting things, and one of the reasons we brought you on here today, this PureCart system seems like it's fairly easy for a retailer to implement to clean off the shopping carts. So first, I was wondering if you can talk a little bit to the back-end implementation of it from a retailer's perspective, how they would go about installing a unit or multiple units in their stores.
Yeah, actually, this is about the fourth iteration of this product, and really right now we've got it down to a system that only needs to be done approximately once a week. The chemical that's involved in it makes a nano coating on the cart itself, and then it'll stay active or antimicrobial for typically up to 7 to 10 days. So it's something that, while we think it's really great to promote and make sure that you would make the customers aware of it through signage, stickers, posters, things like that, and then we can help a retailer with that. But really, this is something that can be sort of in the back end of the store, do it in off hours, do it when it's a convenient thing. It's not something that has to be done every time the carts come back into the stores, every time somebody touches them. The first iteration of the actual unit itself, it did have that. It was something that needed to be used every day. So this is a pretty good change for us.
You mentioned the signage. You mentioned the dialogue there from the retailer to the consumer, letting them know, hey, we use a system to make sure that these shopping carts are antimicrobial and that type of thing. How important is that? And then also, what's some of the feedback that you've gotten from the retailers you work with regarding what they've heard from customers about putting their health as a priority?
Good question again. We've had some exit surveys done when we were doing pilot programs, and the feedback was overwhelmingly positive by consumers saying this made a difference to them. It was, you know, high, like 89 or 90% of people said that they would shop at a store that had this as a service for them, because they truly look at that as a convenience or a service. It isn't just something that's there. That was part of the feedback, is that, okay, wipes are great, but basically, it's just something that I do. I can bring wipes in my purse or my pocket and do the same thing. It's convenient that they're there, but I still have, there's an activity for me, where this is more of something where the retailer's actually doing it on behalf of the consumer. It's giving them a better shopping experience, is what we're trying to make that connection.
When you look at the shopping cart, obviously so important to everything in retail. We're still using shopping carts as icons for, obviously, e-commerce sites. So in terms of retail in general, and in terms of not only the services that you provide, but making sure that the shopping carts are still a relatively clean place for customers, how important is it for that business to kind of communicate to the customer, where the customer knows that this mark, this integral part of retail, is clean enough for my child or whoever to touch it?
Yeah, we believe it's very important, but just like anything else, I think there's a sector of the retail market, of that marketplace, that's going to say, I look at this as a cost, and then there's others that are going to look at this and say, this is a feature and this is a benefit. This is something that I'm doing on behalf of my customer, and I'm going to convert additional customers because of this. It's the same reason that some supermarkets or some groceries are putting in more advanced, let's say, deli counters or food bars, and actually encouraging their customers to come in and have an experience, sit down, have a glass of wine, have a salad, spend more time in our store. Kind of the same thing, that the retailers that look at that and go, oh, that's too expensive, I could never do that, it'll never pay for itself, that's not the market segment that is going to go with this kind of a product. They're going to look at it and say, I can put a tub of wipes up there, and if people want to wipe it down, they can't. There's another section of the market that's going to say, I want to enhance the shopping experience. I want to be the store or the chain, or I want to be nationally known for having the healthiest, cleanest environment. They take care of their restrooms. They take care of their public seating areas. They take care of other areas. This is just one that it's really, it's not on the radar screen yet. To be honest with you, we were probably 5 or 6 years ahead of the curve, and you know, we should be trying to launch this business right now, and we'd probably get more traction.
So if I'm a retailer that has a PureCart system within my confines, where is that PureCart system set up, and how do my employees run the carts through that system?
Good question. When we first started, when we first launched the product, we were trying to make it right center, out front, so sort of in the front of the store. Really, right now, with the way that we've changed it around, it's pretty portable. It can be stored in a back room or a back area or in an area that's simply out of the way. It doesn't make any noise, doesn't have a lot of bells and whistles. It's not trying to draw attention to it. It's very easy to operate. The carts can be nested, so you can run 5 or 10 carts through at a time. We don't suggest to run 500 carts through at a time, but small batches, 5 or 10. The unit itself has a little remote control, so if you're ready to run some carts through, you turn the system on, it sprays a super, super light mist, and we're just trying to get the carts damp. When you run the last cart through, you shut the machine off. So it's a start-stop operation. There's no really complicated sensors to it. You do need to have some human intervention. There's no conveyor belts or anything like that, but it's pretty straightforward. So it's something that anybody could operate, but it's also safe in that there's a remote on it. There's no button to stop and start this thing other than with the remote. So when it sits there and nobody's around it, somebody could walk in it and nothing would happen to them. There's no moving parts to it.
Sounds fairly easy for just about any retailer to use. Well, speaking about retail implementation, what's the reach of this product so far, if you don't mind me asking? I know a lot of times companies can't divulge who they're working with and that type of thing, but so far, what's the reach of the PureCart system?
Yeah, actually, that is a good question. We actually started out, we had good implementation with a couple chains. One large chain, unfortunately, that chain hit financial struggles, and they went into receivership for bankruptcy. And so we kind of backtracked a little bit and sort of relaunched the product. In the U.S., there's not a great reach. We're actually getting more traction and more implementation and more requests from Europe and other areas outside of the U.S. There are more inquiries or several inquiries right now for our other system, which is called Mobile Mist, which is the more dedicated to do shopping carts, but you certainly could use it to do shopping carts as well as any other area of your store, such as the checkout belts, public seating areas, you know, restrooms, other parts, things like that. So anything that doesn't necessarily fall into the shopping cart category.
Well, as a self-professed germaphobe, I certainly hope a few more American retailers pick up this system. Jeff Taylor, president of PureChem Systems, thanks so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Okay, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we once again thank Jeff for joining us on the Retail Focus podcast. Anyone interested in those shopping cart systems can check out their website, purechemsystems.com. purechemsystems.com. It's a neat deal. You can go out, watch videos on how those things work, and it seems like something that would certainly work for a number of retailers to communicate to their customers that certainly they do care about the overall health surrounding their shopping carts. Well, let's wrap up the Retail Focus with our final segment, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I talk about one story that we're looking ahead to and keeping an eye on over the next week or the next month. And Leighton, we begin with you.
Well, I'll keep mine short. We were just talking about divesting in terms of Sunoco selling off a lot of their stores, but this with an apparel retailer that has been struggling as of late. Nine West Holdings is reportedly looking to divest parts of their business, but also renegotiate and restructure more than $1 billion of debt. And this comes by way of CNBC's Lauren Thomas, and she reports that the goal is actually to file Chapter 11 bankruptcy after they get all the creditors lined up. And this is going to happen before March of this year. So we talk about apparel being a very tough industry. Nine West is in the fray when it comes to apparel retailers that have been struggling as of late. You look at that debt, Trent, $1 billion in debt. And really, this is all due to a credit payment coming due in March. So they want to get everything streamlined and lined up so that they have all their ducks in a row when it comes to providing that Chapter 11 bankruptcy notice. And I think this is interesting because you have a March 15th interest payment that's coming due, but yet the store really hasn't told sources what they're planning to do in terms of what parts of the business they're going to divest. So still a lot of question marks out there, a lot of it happening in a short time frame. We're talking just in about 7 or 8 weeks or so. The store and the store's management are going to have to make a lot of tough decisions.
Well, I'm looking ahead to the outdoor sales sector in retail, more specifically Tractor Supply Company, as they'll report their fourth quarter 2017 results coming up on January 31st, 2018. Now, this upcoming year for Tractor Supply Company, as always, the first couple of quarters could be tweaked one way or the other by the weather. The reason I'm looking towards these fourth quarter results are not so much towards the results themselves, although their earnings have been robust and their same store sales have been growing over the last few quarters. What I'm looking at more is any advanced guidance on how the overly cold weather and how this latest streak of snow throughout the United States has affected sales. Tractor Supply Company services a lot of rural areas, most especially with some large ticket items, including snow plow attachments for trucks and, of course, just the road salt that you might see. And anytime it snows a lot, their sales tend to go up in the first quarter. I'll be looking at guidance from them to see if perhaps they moved more of these items, especially some of those bigger ticket items, and we'll see if they can make the bitterly cold and the snow pay off on their behalf. That'll do it here for the Retail Focus podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent. Big thanks once again to Charles Jackson of Pricer and also Jeff Taylor of PureChem for joining us here on today's podcast. Make sure and follow us at Retail Focus on Instagram and Twitter. And as always, subscribe and rate us wherever you access your podcast.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.